I'd like to welcome you to this session. This is session 275, Adventures with DNA, How a Simple Test Led Two LDS Women on Strange but Blessed Journeys of Discovery. So hopefully it will be very strange. That sounds pretty intriguing. Our presenters this afternoon are, first of all, I'm supposed to remind you, if you've switched those phones back on, please switch them back off so we don't get little telephone jingles recording. And the tapes for this session should be available tomorrow morning, maybe this evening. They've been really fast getting them out. Our two presenters are Marilee Mitchum. And Marilee is a convert to the church, but is a sixth-generation Mormon on her mother's side, which I hope she will explain. That sounds rather intriguing. And Marilee met Joanna by email after Joanna's Sunstone article last summer. Joanna Briscoe wrote about having her DNA tested on her husband's and what that implied for genealogical information. Joanna blogs on LDS blogs as J.A. Benson, if you want to find her there. And she will be our concluding speaker, and then we'll have time for comments afterwards. So we'll turn the time over to Marilee now. Thank you.
This is my this is the story of my adventure with DNA, which I celebrate. And my first sentence needs to be one of thanks to Dan Wotherspoon and Joanna Benson, who have recently changed my life by introducing DNA results as a spiritual theme of sorts. After reading Joanna's blog article in the June 2007 issue of Sunstone, I had myself tested where she had, at DNA Tribes, accessed online as dnatribes.com. I should say that a few years ago I did have a first DNA test with Oxford Ancestors after I read Brian Seitz's book, The Seven Daughters of Eve, which informed me that it's now possible to follow the mitochondrial genetic marker passed on from mother to mother to mother over thousands of years. A mind-boggling idea. The result from that test thrilled and amazed me, but there was no shock because it supported the ethnicity I knew already. My daughter of Eve is Tara, the Celtic haplotype originating in northern Italy some 17,000 years ago. For Pete's sake, that's 2,000 years before dogs were domesticated as pets. Amazing. At this end of time, I could already reliably trace my Mormon mother five generations back to a Jane Dunn, born in Carlisle, PA, about 1790. She married a James Elliott in January of 1811 in a Presbyterian church. They were obviously Scots-Irish. My only disappointment was that even with the help of a professional genealogist, I was not able to identify either of the Dunn-Elliott parents. I seemed to be stuck in the new world, except I knew from reading Dorothy Dunnett novels that the name Elliott is a very common one among Scottish families along England's northern border. My mother thought of herself as English, of Norman descent. So finding myself a direct descendant of Tara on my mother's side meant that I had Scotch-Irish on both sides. Great. I felt like I looked it. My girlhood name was Mary Lee Daniel. I was the granddaughter of Mary Pope McCall and Edgar Hugh Daniel from Atlanta, Georgia. No mystery. A very white-bred American girl. Now, that's my father. This is my handsome father, Hugh McCall Daniel. To me, he looked like a combination of Rhett Butler and Elvis Presley. His eyes were strikingly blue, unlike mine, which are a lighter blue. He had no siblings, and neither did I, so comparisons between who had black hair and who had brown were not a factor. My mother's eyes were hazel, and she had light brown hair. She was a Bainbridge-Robinson mix from Idaho and Wyoming. So what does my DNA tell me? DNA Tribes gives you pages of information regarding interpretation of results. I read them and I asked questions, but I didn't approach my results like a scientist. To me, they were more like a spiritual, albeit statistical, revelation given me for my pleasure and improvement. And it certainly did improve my genealogy efforts. The biggest surprise was learning that I'm a mestizo. Lots of Americans are, but I'm really big time. I have particularly strong mestizo match in Ecuador. Statistically speaking, my total combination of alleles, is that how you pronounce it? Is 1,366.69 times as common in Ecuador as in the world. I would even be more mestizo there than is common there. On another page, I was told that my, quote, closest genetic relatives today, end quote, are, in descending order, the Arizona Hispanics in first place, the people in Misiones, Argentina, in second, and the Huetes from Mallorca, Spain, in third, and then it goes on down from there. DNA Tribes gives you at least your top 20 matches looked at from three different angles. On this list of my closest genetic relatives today, I don't get to Scotland till number 6, but it's still a strong match. However, out of 20 matches, 14 are Hispanic and 1 is Portuguese, and I'm someone who, until this test, had no knowledge of any Hispanic names or family members from that ethnic group. I thought there must be some mistake. So using my deceased mother's name, I sent in my DNA again. Nope, no mistake. I've since found a family paper that says, a mimeographed fading paper, that says my Georgia Meads were named DePrado before they got to England. I would call that Portuguese. I then decided to do 3 extra tests called panels for Native American, African, and Asian. I tested positive for all 3. For all of them, with Native American being by far the strongest. That's what makes me a mestizo. According to the contact person at DNA Tribes, my DNA is most consistently read as 25% Native American. The top 2 Asian matches were the Tartars from a region in northwest Poland and the Kyrgyz from Chinese Turkestan. My research of these Tartars shows them to be in the same Polish region, Pomerania-Kujawi, but divided quietly between the Eastern Orthodox Christians, the Jewish, and the Muslim religions. As for the Kyrgyz from Chinese Turkestan, as I remember, they are Muslim. All in all, I had 6 Asian matches. Those were just the 2 strongest. The African panel is extremely interesting. All the matches were very slight, but there are so many of them, 30. The strongest one is with Tanzania. My total combination of alleles is 8.76 times as common in Tanzania as in the world. I'm almost 3 times as likely to be Zulu as in the world. That's what Oprah thought she was, and she really wanted to be that, until she found out she wasn't. And I'm thinking, maybe I'm more Zulu than Oprah, which I think would be pretty cool. As for my known Northern European roots, they are, from the longest, most comprehensive point of view, my 2nd strongest match. I go back at least 500 years to Strathclyde, Scotland, and I also I test positive for Dundee and Glasgow, as well as 3 hits for Ireland. I only have 1 match each for France, Germany, and Belgium, but they are strong too, especially Toulouse, France. But it is Southwest Europe / Mediterranean that comes in first, with Spain, Portugal, Italy, and the Balearic Islands. My southern grandmother had told me her McCalls came from Glasgow, so seeing Glasgow as part of my results grounded me a little. But later I realized that the Jewish quarter in Palma, Mallorca, one of the Balearic Islands, was known as the Call, C-A-L-L. Now I think that since the prefix math means son of, my McCall family were basically sons of the Jewish quarter in Palma, Mallorca. Also the same for my Palmer ancestors. I think that surname is likely derived from Palma, the capital of Mallorca, Spain, where my alleles are 5,000 times, 678, more common than in the world at large. Scotland doesn't even almost beat the odds for those deep ancestral origins. I'll return to Mallorca in a minute. There were no matches for England or Holland at all, not on any page. That was a huge mental surprise, since I'm a several times over Mayflower descendant, with mostly English but a few Dutch-sounding surnames. However, my gut had already told me that those countries weren't my countries of origin when I went there for the first time. Not till I'd been to France and Scotland did I sense ancestry. I'd begun talking to Joanna Benson Briscoe via email about this, and she asked me if I had the Anatolian bump on the back of my skull, just where my neck attaches. I do. She also mentioned characteristics having to do with my teeth, which I have, that commonly indicate Native American ancestry. Hearing about this was a major breakthrough, because by Googling these characteristics, I stumbled upon Melungeons and mixed blood in the South. I found a gold mine, which revealed the research that's being done these days by a small handful of reputable scholars who are themselves Melungeon. Mostly it's Mercer University Press in Macon, Georgia, where the Melungeon Research Committee is gathering and publishing, but there are other people in projects which are also doing this ethnographic investigation. Anyone can type in Melungeon on Google and find hugely interesting material. And this is not irrelevant to those of us in this room, or I wouldn't be giving this paper at Sunstone. Here is a part of N. Brent Kennedy's foreword to Elizabeth Hirschman's 2005 book titled Melungeons, The Last Lost Tribe in America. Kennedy founded the Melungeon Research Committee. He says, quote, Elizabeth Hirschman has written a thought-provoking and controversial book. In essence, Hirschman contends that the so-called mystery people of the American Southeast, the Melungeons, are but the tip of the iceberg of a much broader population of Semitic origins that fled from various regions of the world to America. In her fascinating treatise, Hirschman provides evidence and documents that support her position that the European powers of the 16th and 17th centuries were settling the New World not with their own children, but instead with the children of those they considered ethnically and religiously undesirable. She sees the Jewish diaspora as having extended to the rugged peaks of Appalachia as surely as it extended to Eastern Europe, the Mediterranean, and Central Asia. She cites cultural and religious ties, oral tradition, physical appearances, and genetics as evidence of our nation's more diverse heritage, and she presents her evidence with passion and conviction. End quote. I also have her second book titled When Scotland Was Jewish, and for us Scots-Irish particularly, it's a must-read. It turns out that the borderland Scots-English Elliots have a primary DNA match with China. Maybe that's where my own match originated. After China comes Iran and Spain. Researching the web, I found various lists of surnames and Appalachian counties where these Melungeon families are known to have settled. A scholar named Donald Yates, who co-wrote When Scotland Was Jewish, looks at Tennessee particularly, but that might be called the sheer tip of the iceberg. He says, quote, the simple message we would like to share is this. Melungeons were crypto-Jews. Now, I know that word crypto is in vogue, especially in talking about the Southwest right now. It makes me a little nervous. It sort of brings up in my mind conspiracy theories and all that. But you have to be careful, you know, when you use the Internet, what you look at and what you really take from. But anyway, this is what he asserts. That means they were people who were, now I'm saying it myself, that means they were people who were secretly practicing Judaism as they were able to remember it, having been expelled from their synagogues and often under extreme pressure, having converted to Catholicism to escape the Inquisitions in Spain and Portugal in 1492 and 1497 respectively. It's become more widely acknowledged that there were crypto-Jews in South America and in the American Southwest from as early as the 16th century. Outwardly, they were often Catholic, but within their families, they practiced elements of their former religion. There is a saying, I'm told, in Latin America, Catholic by faith, Jewish by blood, which indicates at least that in some areas of the New World, memory of non-Catholic days is still part of family identity. But until these Melungeon researchers publicly presented their private investigations, no scholars that I know of thought the Appalachians had any history of that sort. I now realize it was known informally. Watch the old Robert Mitchum movie Thunder Road and be alert for clues. There's also a strong Moorish flavor to this crypto-Judaism, especially in my Mediterranean families. After all, the Moors were top dog in Spain from 711 AD until the 1200s, and they still had some control until 1492 when Ferdinand III and Isabel captured Granada. Then all Iberia became Catholic. It is generally known that many Jewish families surreptitiously fled to France even before the Inquisition. They entered under the rubric Portuguese merchants. That false identity was really no disguise. Catalonia is the strongest match I have in Spain proper, and I know it is just over the border from Toulouse, France, where I'm also strongly matched. My Mormon grandfather found himself in France and Belgium on his mission, and I wonder if he knew he had roots there. Not that I know he does. Those could be southern roots. The first Melungeon surname list that I ever saw just bowled me over because so many of my family names were there. Smith, Robinson, Walker, Wood, Holmes, Adams, Miner, Cook, Brown, Moss, Lewis. But none of these people of mine were from the South. My main Southern names were Daniel, McCall, Mead, Culberson, Gray, Bird, Tharp, Watson. And then there's the Majorcan wrinkle to which I already referred. It is the very strongest match I have on the Deep Ancestry page. Majorca is an island in the Balearic chain off the east coast of Spain. Originally, the Melungeons on the eastern coast claimed to be Portuguese from Minorca, an island next to Majorca. Anyway, I was seriously statistically likely descended from a group called Huete, which is an insulting word. These people were Catholics who were ethnically a mixed-blood community of Jewish people from Muslim North Africa. Their forced conversion had come in the middle 1300s, and they had a lot of Moorish blood, not to mention Roman, Vandal, and Byzantine. But they were looked down on for being Catholic conversos, or in other words, Jews who pretended to convert. No one ever forgot from whom they were descended. This was partly because they had secretly maintained their economic and kinship networks, not to mention their secret practice of Judaism, while publicly practicing Catholicism. The word Huete apparently is a slur meaning pigs, as in pork, which was not eaten by Jews unless they did it a lot to show they were no longer Jewish. They remained persecuted by the peasantry off and on until they fled, most of them to South America and the Caribbean, where I have all my New World Hispanic matches, except for the Hispanics in Arizona. That's number one. Anyway, online I found them to sound like people I wouldn't expect to be related to, although I did find descriptions of North African Muslim Berbers as being often blue-eyed. Plus, I already knew that areas of Spain are Celtic and that many of the people in those areas have reddish hair and blue eyes. I have a match with Cantabria, Spain, which is particularly Celtic. As an aside, Carl's over there, my husband, the blue shirt. Our girls all have reddish highlights, even those whose hair is almost black. And it's interesting to me that all three of our daughters have brown eyes, and yet all seven of our grandchildren have blue eyes. So, whoa, not only did I think that I had no Hispanic names, but I had no Jewish or Islamic ancestry that I knew of in my family. That my maiden name was Daniel is a standard Sephardic Jewish surname escaped me until recently. So this was ridiculously exciting to think about and research. And now, after months of reading, a year, I should say, of reading, Googling, and going over genealogy papers, I see that I can pretty much say the same thing about myself that Elizabeth Hirschman says about herself. Quote, I had always been told I was Scotch-Irish, English, Presbyterian in ancestry, and had always felt secure in my tidy WASP ethnicity. Through DNA testing and genealogical tracing, however, I now know I am actually primarily of Spanish-Iberian descent with Semitic and Native American tossed in for good measure, end quote. I, too, am primarily of Spanish-Iberian descent, and I now have credible circumstantial evidence that all four of my grandparents have barely hidden Jewish roots, not to mention a common history of primitive Baptist alliances. These primitive Baptist churches, according to Hirschman, were a favorite place for crypto-Jews to gather in very early America. Joseph Lee Robinson, my Mormon grandfather's Mormon grandfather, had a Baptist minister grandfather named Joseph Lee on his mother's side. And on microfiche, he writes in so many words that this grandfather was more Jewish and his other grandfather, Samuel Brown, was more Native American. The very name Lee could actually be Chinese and not even Western. It is a common Asian surname. Now I put up a, there's a pictures. Here's a photo of my grandfather, Orrin Robinson, with what we call his Robinson eyes. I think he may be the carrier of the Polish Tartar genes, too. I have a sense that Asia and the Ukraine figure in that side of my family. The photo of me in sixth grade looks like I could be part Asian for sure, at least to me. And the one of me now looks ethnic, although it's harder for me to see it in the mirror, but Joanna says she can see it. But going back to Elizabeth Hirschman's work, the early Melanesians in Appalachia were multi-language, multi-ethnic, international people who had an almost non-existent status in the post-Inquisition world of the 16th and 17th century. Quite a few of them who didn't live inland piloted ships and were known euphemistically as New Christian explorers or as Portuguese merchants or sometimes as privateers. The genealogy starts from my Robinson line at Samuel Robinson, who was a sea captain out of Massachusetts in the early 1600s. Portuguese merchants made money, and they also very conveniently carried their kin to places of refuge. Recently, I asked my 92-year-old uncle if he knew anything about us formerly being Jewish, and he replied slowly, I seem to remember something about that. That jogged my own memory. Before she died, I quizzed my mother about our Robinson ancestors, and she said we probably had Indian and there was supposed to be somebody from Sicily. Sicily, that Italian seafaring place? Now I own a book titled Discovering Your Sephardic Ancestors and Their World by Jeffrey Malka. He mentions that even long after 1492, the many Jews who fled Portugal for the Kingdom of Sicily spoke three primary languages, Sicilian, Arabic, and Hebrew. We're talking about intelligent people who, out of necessity, learned many languages. Think Dutch, English, and French, just to name a few more. This allowed them to do work as translators, even in the wilderness with the Indians. My southern grandmother's brother was actually a translator for Herbert Hoover in South America and France. Now that's ironic that there's no time to go there. It is thought by many that Abraham Lincoln was Melungeon. There's good evidence. Everyone in America proudly thinks of this country as a melting pot. But the surprising thing I've discovered is that I, and also many who carry the names handed down to me, were already a huge melting pot when we got here. And many, many of us show circumstantial evidence in our genes, and also in the route of these genes migrations, that indicate we were directly impacted by the Spanish and Portuguese inquisitions in a way that never occurred to most of us. Certainly not to me, the little Gentile Scots-Irish lass. I used to wonder why the Book of Mormon put down the Catholic Church so baldly, and now I feel that I have a context for that. Let me reiterate that this is all a very juicy subject for inquiry, but it takes a sleuth because there's no one volume a person can read. DNA is shedding a lot of scattered here and there light on the likelihood that this country was not founded by Anglo-Saxons to the extent we have always been taught. And my own DNA gives me reason to believe that in spite of almost 100% Anglicized names in my family, a lot of truth has been either withheld from me or forgotten. As I say, I found clues filling out this DNA on both sides of my family, all four lines of grandparents, all well before 1800. Both Joanna and I found household practices taught to us that are traditionally shared among the Jews, the Muslims, the Melungeons, maybe the Gypsies, the Roma, but not among the Northern Europeans. We could talk all day. Instead, I'll close by showing a few of the beautiful Melungeon women in my family. These four are good representations of that triracial group. Let me put my... To the right is Alice Mead Gray Daniel. She's my Daniel, my father's grandmother on the Daniel side. On the left is a McCall ancestor on my grandmother's side, my southern grandmother, Lila Annetta Kress. And then there are two more. Sylvia Adelaide Kress is the daughter of Lila, and she's my father's first cousin. And the last picture is Emily Horn, who's one of Carl's and my beautiful dark beauties. Thank you.
To say it's an honor to be here. Many of you in the audience today, like me, are proud descendants of Mormon pioneers. We are confident in our knowledge of our Western European heritage. Now that I've said that, I want everyone to find a little bit of their skin, and I want you to look at it. And while you're looking at your skin color, I want you to remember, it doesn't matter. Perhaps unknown to you is that you may also have Hebrew ancestors hidden in your lineage. After our session today, you will have the tools to search for and possibly locate hidden Sephardic Jews in your heritage. A year ago, my husband and I decided to get DNA testing to determine our ethnicity. We decided to use a DNA company called DNA Tribes, which analyzes one's DNA to determine ancestry for the last 500 years. The DNA testing showed probability of ancestral origins only in stationary populations. When our DNA test results came back, we were confused. As Mayflower Pilgrim descendants, we expected to see traces of Native American and African mixed with a lot of Western European. Instead, my husband's test shows that his stationary populations are predominantly Indian, with African, Western European, Mediterranean, and Middle Eastern. One thing that I found out when I looked into the India, people that came from India, it was in the 1400s to the 1500s, thousands of Indians left that country and went all over Western Europe. And also that these India people, it also tells what caste that they belong to. Now, someone might say, well, that's gypsy. Some of the ones at the bottom could maybe be, but the gypsies kind of left India a good 500 years probably before that. And these are higher caste people. These are, you know, your business people and your military class. On my test, I am shown to be predominantly Eastern European, with North African, with Middle Eastern, Mediterranean, and Western European. It's interesting to note that I am 97% more North African than the rest of the U.S. population. That means that 3% of Americans are more North African than I am, and I don't tan. On another page of the test, it is noted that we have some mestizo ancestry, meaning European, African, and Native American mix. Later, we had my parents tested also by DNA tribes, and their results were close enough to validate my test. Our results were vastly different than either of us had been led to believe. Both of us were the descendants of Mormon pioneers on every familial line. Both of us, oh, this chart, I'm sorry, shows the surnames and or maiden names of our ancestors when they joined the LDS Church. My husband's ancestors are color-coded blue, and mine is pink. This chart shows our European ancestors in the decade when our ancestor joined the LDS Church and immigrated to Utah or Idaho, and where they were living when they joined. My husband's ancestors joined the church in the 1830s, and the last pioneers arrived in Idaho in the 1880s. My ancestors first joined the church in the 1830s, and the last converts were in Utah by the early 1860s. Our combined line, the Benson Messenger family, who joined in 1831, are noted in green. If our convert ancestors were North Americans at the time they joined the church, I have listed when, where, and if known, to what country they could be traced. On paper, my husband was British, Swiss, and German, and I was British, Danish, and French, and we thought ourselves to be the typical Western European Mormon pioneer stock. At that point, my search for my ancestral roots took a very different turn. After a few days of spontaneously singing We Are the World, while my kids rolled their eyes, I got busy and I began to search. And I easily found on my husband's Swiss line, sorry, of Kuntz, which is a Jewish name. The surnames, Wasim, Iman, which are both Middle Eastern names, Kohli, common name in India, Mani, which is Indian and Iranian, and Zagli, which is Mediterranean. I discovered that his Swiss ancestral home of Bern, Switzerland, has had a long history of large multi-ethnic immigrations which have become communities. After my article in Sunstone titled DNA Mormons, I was introduced to Merrily through Dan Wotherspoon. Years earlier, I had investigated as a possible related ancestry the East Tennessee Melungeon community. The mysterious Melungeons were typically tall, olive skin, and a dark-haired people who occasionally had blue eyes. Our combined Messenger-Benson line looked similar to the Melungeons. I spent hours trying to find a connecting link between my Messenger-Bensons and the East Tennessee Melungeons, and except for a Melungeon barber line that may or may not have had any connection with my New England barber line, the search was fruitless. My search was especially frustrating because concrete evidence was not to be found, but yet, as if trying to catch raindrops, I could see something, but I could not catch what it was long enough to hold on to it. Merrily told me of updates on the Melungeon studies that some researchers had expanded to include Northern Georgia, Kentucky, Virginia, West Virginia, North and South Carolina, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, upstate and Long Island, New York. So the possibility of our Melungeon type ancestry now seemed quite plausible. Later, Merrily called telling me that she had exciting news that my possible Melungeons were also Sephardic Jews. Now, my initial feeling, I have to confess, was that Merrily was a sweet and intelligent person, but was most likely the mayor of Crazy Town.
times.
So dear Merrily persisted, so to placate her, I read N. Brent Kennedy's The Melungeons, The Resurrection of a Proud People, and Melungeons, The Last Lost Tribe in America by Elizabeth Hirschman, and When Scotland Was Jewish by Hirschman and Donald Yates. All three books are an amazing body of work written by tenacious researchers who are they themselves the descendants of Appalachian Melungeons. Brent Kennedy's book tells of his search to find the truth in relation to his Melungeon ancestors. Kennedy theorized that mysterious hill people in the Appalachians, Mediterranean facial features, olive complexions, dark hair, and sometimes blue eyes were of Portuguese or Turkish extraction, mixed with other ethnicities in America, rather than just being plain old Scotch-Irish, Native American, and African American. The Melungeons themselves had always claimed that they were Portuguese, or Portuguese, Turk, and Spanish, and they were derided by academia for their supposedly lofty presumptions. Hirschman and Yates took it one step further and theorized that the Melungeons were also cryptic Sephardic Jews and converso. By definition, crypto-Jews are Jews who publicly hide their observance of their Jewish religion. They celebrate their faith at home behind heavily drawn curtains and hushed whispers. They outwardly appear to have embraced their new religion by attending services on Sunday and baptizing their children. Conversos are those who have completely converted over to Christianity, but they are aware of their Jewish heritage. They are also the ones who, at some point in time, choose not to pass the information down to their descendants. Elizabeth Hirschman, a professor from Rutgers University, laid out startling evidence of naming patterns in crypto-Jewish families. And then later with Donald Yates, they found historical and scientific DNA evidence of Hebrew heritage deeply rooted with the Scottish culture and history. I took some time to investigate my family lines. I thought such a task would take a week or so to cover all my lines. I'm still looking at my lines. But anyway, instead, I found that the messenger or messenger and the veil and the Alfred or the Alvard lines closely follow the formula in given names as described by Elizabeth Hirschman. Now, I will take you through my lines because it's the only way I know to show you how to look for clues in your lines. The messenger, often Messinger family, is a good example. Andrew, who was born in 1588, and his wife Sarah immigrated to colonial America, were the parents of Edward, Andrew, and Henry. Later grandson Nathaniel, born in 1653, married Rebecca Kelsey, who was a descendant of pilgrim Stephen Hopkins. Their children's names show the typical Puritan name of return and what I will label as safe biblical names such as Hannah, Rebecca, Joseph, John, Nathan, or Nathaniel. Son Joseph, using the Jewish spelling of the surname Messinger, and wife Catherine Holcomb have the Jewish biblical names of Isaiah, Ezekiel, Sarah, Elijah, Isaac, Joseph, Nathaniel, and Jehiel, with one English name of Catherine. Son Isaac, born in 1717, married a Hannah Alford. Alford name is sometimes Alvord or Alvard, and Alvard is close to several Sephardic Spanish names such as Alvarez and Alvardo. They named their children less safe biblical names such as Joseph, Hannah, Dorcas, Simeon, Isaac, Moses, Aaron, Reuben, Elisha, and Abner. The last three names are typically Sephardic, such as Rosie, after the Sephardic Rose, Keziah from the Old Testament, and Carmi. Now, Carmi is unusual. I looked at the censuses in the late 1700s and the early 1800s, and there are only a spare handful of Carmi, which is decidedly a non-New Englandish sort of name that's found on the Sephardic Gen website as a North African Jewish name. Son Joseph Messenger, the son of the previous Isaac, born in 1741, married Jemima Barber. Jemima is also a Sephardic name. They have Joseph, and Cornish, which is a family surname, Jemima, Heman, Zabina, Ebenezer, Jedediah, and Keziah. Biblical Jewish names such as Alva, Chloe, and Rhoda are typical Sephardic Melungeon names. I spent about a month on the family search looking at direct and indirect lines, and I saw this pattern repeated a number of times where, while in Europe, the names were typically safe English names such as Henry, William, and Catherine. Later in the Americas, the names became increasingly Sephardic, as in Keziah, Isaac, and Eliakim. I was now a new convert to the theory of Melungeons as Sephardic Jews, so I guess this makes me vice mayor of Crazy Town. before I go any further, I need for you to understand the significance of the Sephardim in ancient history. According to Rabbi Ham Levi, in 826 BC, King Solomon sent out a large group of Israelites to the land of Tarshish, later called Spain. These people became known as the Sephard in Hebrew. Now, this map shows the migrations of the Jewish people in medieval times. We will mainly concern ourselves with the Sephardic Jews, and as you can see, there were migrations in and out and within the countries of Europe and the Islamic kingdoms. 1,000 or so years ago, the entire Jewish population was expelled from Palestine. No, I can't get that thing to work. Okay. I don't know that I could do that talk at the same time anyway. Okay, find Palestine is down there by Egypt, towards the bottom of the paper. Over the time, the Jews scattered through the Middle East. And then they went to North Africa, Asia, Mediterranean, and Europe. Mary Lee and I have concerned ourselves with the Sephardic Jews, but the groups have intermingled, and as well as many of you are probably, all have the three groups hidden in our ancestry. It is from the Sephardic Jews that the ethnic slur of the wandering Jew was coined. The story goes that the wandering Jew was sentenced to wander as punishment for the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. However, choose to view my Sephardic Jewish ancestors as amazing survivors in a hostile world. As the Jews meandered on their journeys, it was as if they were caught in this revolving door as they gained converts and lost members to Islam and Christianity. This is why Hebrew DNA is often difficult to find, as it has been largely unstable through the centuries. The Jewish people are not a nationality or a country of origin. The Jews were especially gifted in business and were sought after by rulers of many countries. Initially, groups of Jews settled in small numbers in various countries, but after a while their number and influence would grow, and consequently the native population would grow to resent the power the Jews had. The natives would then brutally strike out against the Jews, repeating an ebb and a flow pattern of persecution and subsequent preservation. For instance, by 1100 AD, an early Jewish population in England had been established. But anti-Jewish riots and widespread murders began in 1189, and the English Jewish community was finally expelled in 1271 after repeated requests to be allowed to leave. Many of the English Sephardic Jews moved to Scotland, where they joined Scottish Sephardic Jews who had already established a presence a few centuries earlier. Thus, the Jews in Scotland and the few remaining Jews in England learned a valuable survival lesson, which was to assimilate as a protective measure against losing their fortunes and their very lives. And this information is documented in Elizabeth C. Hirschman and Donnellan Yates's When Scotland Was Jewish. Meanwhile, in Spain and Portugal, the Muslims and North African Moors ruled the land. The Islamic rulers were usually open-minded and accepting of the Jews and the Christians, who were a large part of the Spanish population. This openness eventually cost the Muslims their power. The Catholics rose up and drove their Islamic occupiers out of Spain, leaving thousands of Moor and Jewish people to fend for themselves against what became known as the Spanish Inquisition, which lasted from 1478 till 1834. The remaining Muslims and Jews were given the choice to be burned at the stake or convert. Some Jews were allowed to leave, and many of these Jews were able to immigrate to Turkey. But for most, leaving was not an option. Leaving triggered an automatic death sentence. Left with no other choice, most Jews and Moors chose to convert. They became known as Jewish converso, or Muslim Moriscos, which incidentally the surname Briscoe is derived from. Many of them truly converted to Christianity, retained some of their Jewish or Muslim beliefs, and at the very least were aware of their Jewish or Muslim heritage. The crypto-Jews went to Mass on Sunday, baptized their children, and were Catholic in public. Secretly, they hid their true identities. They secretly practiced what ceremonies they could in their homes. Then the Inquisition fever spread to Italy and France, resulting in persecution of the Jews and the Moors living there as well. As the Ottoman Empire expanded and later diminished in size and influence, it left its Jewish population vulnerable and open to persecution. some of the Turkish Jews escaped to Western Europe. As their influence diminished and persecution mounted, the Egyptian Jews also immigrated to the West. Now let's talk about how the political events have affected our limited knowledge today of our literal Hebrew ancestry. Similar to the Scottish Crypto-Jews, the Mediterranean Jews and the Morisco Moors came together in solidarity under the guise of Christianity to secretly practice what they could of their religions. They sought ways to escape the brutality of the Catholics. Many escaped under the Spanish or Portuguese flag to practice their faith in the sparsely populated Americas. Others were able to leave for the safety of Western Europe. They found sanctuary in Switzerland, Germany, and especially Scotland. But the trick was not to appear Jewish. Still under the guise of Catholicism, then pretending to convert over the state religion, they preserved their secret religion, lives, and fortunes. The Huguenots also played an important role in preserving the Jews and Muslims. They hid the converso people in their populations, believing them to be the children of Abraham and thus worthy of protection. Many of these conversos remained in their new countries, often truly converting to Christianity after a few generations. The Sephardic Jews became the authors of Masonry and the Scottish Rites movements. The first Masonic lodges in Europe were established perhaps in the middle 1600s and were clearly established in the early 1700s. In the Masonic ceremonies, the Sephardic Jews were able, at long last, to communally practice Orthodox Jewish rituals. The charitable aspect of Masonry fulfilled the Orthodox Jewish promises they had made with God to tend to the poor, the widow, and the orphans. The Spanish Inquisition put intense fear and persecution complexes into the psyche of the Sephardic Jews. As a threat with war with Spain loomed on horizon, the Sephardic Jews in England desired to flee, even though at that time they were not being persecuted in Britain. In desperate fear of Spain, some of the Sephardic Jews left the security of England's relative comforts to risk their lives and families to hostile Indians and starvation in the new American colonies. The Lost Colony of Roanoke and Plymouth Plantation were populated with many of these Sephardic Jews. Wayne Winkler, the author of Walking Towards Sunset, The Melungeons of Appalachia, details evidence of early immigrations of Turks, Gypsies, and free Africans, all of whom earned their freedom after indentured servitude. During the 1600s, some of these free persons of color gained status and wealth, then married white women from the servant class. As the 1700s approached, British immigrants living in the English colonies since the beginning increased in numbers and power. Hirschman puts forth evidence that many of the Sephardic Jews mingled with the mestizo families of whites, Native Americans, blacks, and gypsies. Then the mestizo, or the Sephardic people, later called Melungeons, were pushed out of the colonies by the newcomers and the English population. Thus, the Melungeon, or Sephardic old settlers, became many of the early pioneers in the new Western frontier. Researchers such as Winkler, Kennedy, Yates, Hirschman, and others have identified the core Melungeon or Sephardic names. And we have a handout if anyone's interested afterwards that has those names. Now, an interesting thing happened. Feeling the freedom of living on the frontier, some Sephardic Jews loosened up a bit, began to name their children Sephardic names. For example, Allen. Samuel Allen in England, born 1567, had Thomas, Francis, Rose, Ralph, George, Matthew, William, Walter, and Samuel. Samuel's great-grandson, Nathaniel Allen, and his wife Mary had Edward, Samuel, James, Nathaniel, Sarah, Mary, Ann, Benjamin, John, and Ebenezer. Nathaniel's grandson, John Allen, born in 1712, married to Hulda Hill, had Hannah and Jesse, which are Jewish, Eliakim and Phineas, which are Sephardic, married John, Amos, and James, which are biblical. And what you can take from this is the connectivity of naming patterns and origin of given and surnames. In the great Melungeon migration of the late 1700s, Sephardic explorers such as Daniel Boone, John Savue, Sevier and others explored and purchased Kentucky and East Tennessee from the Native American tribes for the settlement of the Sephardic Jews. Settling in Kentucky came my Simmons ancestors from Maryland. My Hoods, Carters, and Hills came from North Carolina to settle in northern Georgia and later migrated to Kentucky. My husband's Bybees were from North Carolina, East Tennessee, and also later migrated to Kentucky. There were also smaller communities of Melungeons who gathered for a time in upstate and Long Island, New York. Our Bensons, Messengers, Vales, Barneys, and Barbers are amongst these people. Our Messenger Benson family, with a group of others, including some Vales and Blanchards, later moved to the banks of the Ohio River on the Indiana side bordering Kentucky. Abraham Lincoln is a recognized Sephardic Melungeon. His ancestors settled in the Melungeon community in Kentucky, the same community as my Simmons ancestors. Once the Melungeons were out on the frontier, they were free to do as they pleased. There are documented cases by Hirschman of American crypto-Jews who reverted back to an open practice of their Jewish faith, including the relatives of Abraham Lincoln. Many chose to forget their religious practices, and their descendants are now unaware of their ancestors' religion because their Jewishness was so well disassembled by the conversion to Protestantism and the success at assimilation over the centuries. Some of these Sephardic Jews became the founders and early converts of the Campbellite and Primitive Baptist movements. Others, vaguely aware of their Hebrew ethnicity, felt that Israelite tug of being God's chosen people. They were caught between both worlds, belonging to neither. Now, as if I had a magic decoder ring, I could recognize crypto-Sephardic Jews, as they were usually primitive Baptists, were secretive and clannish, often married their cousins, worshipped and married at home rather than in a traditional church. And while in Europe, Sephardic Jews named their children traditional European names. That as they gathered together on the American frontier during and especially the Melungeon migration of the late 17th and early 1800s, many of them felt comfortable in the wilderness to name their children Sephardic Melungeon names. All of these are clues of connectivity. My efforts were rewarded as I found scores of Sephardic names. And this is just a sampling. Names such as Eleazar, Lazarus, Jonah, Barak, Bildad, Eliakim, Alva, Olive, Alonzo, Lorenzo, Alfonso, Zebra, Jude, Elnashi, Solomon, Eber. These are the sampling of the names I found in the Allen, Vail, Messenger, Benson, and related lines. Most names were verified at the Sephardim Genealogy website, archived by Harvard University, and the website by Jeffrey Osmalka. I also learned that names beginning with E-L, such as Elmira, were usually Jewish in origin. A-L names, such as Almira, were Islamic in origin. I have both types of names in my family. The Messenger Benson line was especially fond of A.L. names such as great-great-great-grandfather Alva. This also explains some of the Saudi and Turkish strains in my DNA. And if you want to find out more, here are the websites, www.sephardim.com. That's the Harry Stein website. And then sephardicgen.com. by Jeffrey S. Malka.
Is that a typo in the talking? Is it supposed to be Sephardim?
Well, Sephardim is also another word. It's kind of like, I don't know, their nationality. Harry Stein is a Jewish genealogist. He also has a Yahoo group, if anybody's interested. It's pretty interesting. Elizabeth Hirschman put forth evidence that in coming to America, the Sephardic Jews brought with them the practice of Masonry. Incidentally, down the road and over from my home in Tennessee is a Masonic temple, Hiram Lodge, number 7, built in 1823. This is the first three-story building in Tennessee. It is one of the oldest Masonic temples still in use today. The crypto-Sephardic Jews established some of the very first Masonic lodges in colonial America. I was also introduced to the theory that Masonry is founded in the beliefs and practices of Orthodox Judaism. Sephardic Jews were the major believers in Orthodox Judaism. I found the origin of some of the more unusual names in our genealogy to be Orthodox Jewish. Names such as Salomon, Aphiel, and that's from the Kabbalah, Carmi, of course, Hira, that's Arabic, the cave where Muhammad read Revelation from Angel Gabriel. El Falat, I love that name. If we ever get another dog, that's its name. Arba, Ahira from the Kabbalah and the Hanukkah. Zarina, which is Islamic. Afa, Sina, Alvarez, Alonso, Vida, Elvira, things like that. The way I see it, the Sephardic Jews endured centuries of persecution. Because of these adverse circumstances, they were unable to keep the covenant to its fullest, thus unable to fully retain their birthright. The Melungeons became a type of converso people who mixed their Jewish heritage with Islamic customs and Christian beliefs. I theorize that the Melungeons of New England and in the southern USA were natural converts to a restored doctrine. It must have been a wonderful fulfillment to be reborn as a new kind of covenant people with God. As Latter-day Saints, they now had their birthright restored to them. Many of these Sephardic Mormons appear to end giving their children Jewish names when they joined the LDS Church, but others kept marrying other Sephardic peoples and carrying on the Sephardic names until well into the 1900s. Some of the related Vail and Allen families continued with this naming tradition. Against the backdrop of this amazing historical tapestry, my ancestors played out their lives anonymously until now. Our DNA tests have allowed me to expand my search to include our Mediterranean, Slavic, Middle Eastern, Asian, and African peoples living amongst the native Western European populations. Recently, I looked at my ancestor, Henry C. Clegg from Preston, England, who immigrated to Heber, Utah. Henry made and played dulcimers. Now, here is a picture of one of his dulcimers. As you all can see, it's in a kind of a triangular shape, and it's got two wheels on the front of it, and then there's a triangle and kind of a tambourine thing, and they would play it with hammers and it kind of make a noise. Anyway. Three of his dulcimers are in museums in Utah. The dulcimer is a Middle Eastern instrument called a santur. Henry's dulcimer is fashioned as a santur, and this style is purely Middle Eastern in craftsmanship. Incidentally, the beloved Scottish instrument, the bagpipe, that also originated in the Middle East, found its way to Scotland in the 1500s. I believe that investigating the history of the crypto-Sephardic Jews has the capacity to impact how we view the history of the church. For example, from the Utah History Encyclopedia, there is a popular myth that Orson Hyde was of Jewish ancestry, but of careful investigation has uncovered no evidence that this is true. In contrast, here's an excerpt from the book by Ivan J. Barrett, Joseph Smith and the Restoration. In 1823, only a handful of Jews lived in Palestine, and those who did had no rights under Turkish rule. The roots of Zionism in the Jewish communities of Europe were barely stirring, and the thought of Jews gathering at all was virtually unheard of, let alone a return of the Jews to the land of Palestine. But from that very time on, the spiritual stirrings of the Zionist movement began in earnest. God was about to give special keys to modern prophets as he had done in ancient ones, keys to move the nations. In 1831, only a year after the church was organized by Joseph Smith, another young man with a prophetic call by the name of Orson Hyde, age 26, of Jewish ancestry, was confirmed a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints by the prophet Joseph. When Joseph laid his hands upon the head of Orson Hyde, he gave him a unique blessing, wherein he prophesied the following: "In due time thou shalt go to Jerusalem, the land of thy fathers, and be a watchman unto the house of Israel. And by thy hands shall the Most High do a great work, which shall prepare the way to greatly facilitate the gathering of that people." Now, I took the liberty of checking out Orson Hyde's ancestry by looking at FamilySearch.org. That's a pretty easy thing to do. The name clues are there. Daniel Hyde, Orson Hyde's great-grandfather, and his wife, Deborah Perry. Perry is a known Sephardic Melungeon name. The pear is a Sephardic Jew symbol. Have the following children: Nehemiah, Abijah, Eliahu, Eliakim, Martha, Deborah, John, Daniel, and Eunice. Eliahu is Orthodox Jewish. Eliakim is Sephardic from France and North Africa. And besides his Perry line, Orson Hyde has classic Melungeon surnames in his genealogy, such as Crow, Miller, and Martin ancestors. He's married to a Johnson. That's also classic Melungeon. Hyde was also married to a Price and Lyons, and those are Jewish names. He was also known to visit other supposed Sephardic homes, as in my ancestors, as noted by Polly Benson Bartholomew. Now remember, we have been told we are literally the house of Israel. This is in the doctrine that many of us are Israel through Abraham, and was taught by Joseph Fielding Smith. And he said, "The Lord said he would scatter Israel amongst the Gentile nations, and by doing so, he would bless the Gentile nations with the blood of Abraham. Today, we are preaching the gospel in the world, and we are gathering out according to the revelations given to Isaiah, Jeremiah, and other prophets, the scattered sheep of the house of Israel. These scattered sheep are coming forth mixed with Gentile blood from their Gentile forefathers. Under all the circumstances, it is possible that the majority, almost without exception, of those who come into the church in this dispensation have the blood of two or more of the tribes of Israel as well as the blood of Gentiles." In April 2008, General Conference, Elder Utendorf had this to say. "But what of the faith of the ancient ones before them? What of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Are they not our fathers? Are we not of the house of Israel?" I hardly think my ancestors were unique. Many of the classic Melungeon and Sephardic names are familiar to me. I have glanced at a few of those early families in the church, and I see Melungeon surnames in several of those families. We theorize that the gospel held special appeal to these humble converts, just as today, gospel appeals to people who have been prepared to receive it. Suddenly, our perception of the Mormon pioneers as a group of British and other Western Europeans is clarified as a gathering of multicultural people, of whom many of them were the descendants of Sephardic Jews. It is my belief that when the Lord sent his representatives to the people in the Americas, he had already gathered many of the house of Israel on the frontier. At the same time, he sent Heber C. Kimball and the other missionaries to Western Europe to gather his peoples. God had already reached his hand into the continents of the world and had gathered his nations, kindred, tongues, and peoples, and placed them in the large industrial cities teeming with immigrants from many countries for the missionaries to find. When I look at the various peoples my DNA represents, I realize that in many of these nations, the gospel has not yet flourished or even been allowed within the borders. Knowing the limits of missionary work that we would face today, our omnipotent God had already gathered up his representatives, placed them where they could be found, and returned to the fold. It is my hope that the younger generation will use DNA testing as one of the tools in searching to find the ancestors who are currently lost to family historians. It is my hope that my children and others will be free of the cords of prejudice that have bound the previous generations. I am confident that the younger generation will be curious enough and will be filled with the spirit of Elijah to search in places previously untouched to find the ancestors that desire for their work to be done. In my oldest son Samuel's patriarchal blessing, it was prophesied he would do the work for hundreds of his kindred dead who anxiously await their work to be done. At the time of his blessing, 7 years ago, I wondered how this seemingly impossible task would be accomplished. Now we know the work is never done. The field is white and ready to harvest for us all. And I would like to thank Dan Rotherspoon for introducing me to Mary Lee, and especially Mary Lee for recognizing the Melungeon Sephardic connection in her research and then including me on her journey. Chrissy Coombs, my wonderful editor, and her daughter, Indy Coombs, for her brilliant PowerPoint design. Thank you.
Well, we have a few minutes for questions, comments. If you could please make your comments in the microphone, either that one or this one here, so they go on the tape, and try to make them brief. If you have more than one question, please let someone else have a turn before you ask your second one. I think that will help us all. So go ahead.
Can you hear her?
Well, we've often heard that the Jews were scattered into the north, but it didn't look like from the maps that they went up into Scandinavia. Did you find that they did?
Scandinavia is hard to look at because they changed their name. Oh, I'm sorry.
Scandinavia was hard to look at because they had, you know, their names change every generation. And Marilee at one point said to me, "How many of your grandparents do you think are Sephardic Jewish?" And I said, "Well, I think all of them are, but my Scandinavian grandmother." And then a week or so ago, I decided to sit down and take a look at them. And her father was Abraham Hansen. Abraham's kind of odd for, you know, a Scandinavian person. They're usually peers or hands or whatnot. But I thought, yeah, he moved to America. So I went up the line and I found Lorenz. Lorenz is not Scandinavian. I found Eilerson. That's Lorenz is? Yeah, but it's Lorenz. Yeah, this Lorenzo is, you know, it's
like
right. And so, and then I found Eilerson, and that is Jewish, and Slager, and looked at, you know, lists of people who died in the Holocaust and the Shoah, and Eilerson and Slager were on there. So I can say that they're, and Hirschman says she has also looked at Scandinavian countries. She feels that they're there, but they're just kind of hard to find. So I don't know. Just because we don't know where they are doesn't mean they're not there. What else?
We just encourage them.
Oh, I was just going to say, so unbeknownst to probably most of us, we would have been in eligible for temple, for priesthood and temple persons, if we had only known.
Right.
I have grandparents that I suspect you might not be telling me. They're not telling me anything, mm-hmm. And I suspect this might be why. Any suggestions on, you know, how to crack the code, how to break the shell?
Now, my grandparents have all died. I could tell a story about my grandparents. I don't know if we have enough time. But I did get a clue. I've asked my mother. I said, "Mother, are there any Jewish practice in your family?" And no, I don't have any in town. And then we were at her home in St. George last week. And she was making pancakes for the grandchildren. She was mixing in some eggs, and all of a sudden she got a disgusted look on her face, threw the whole thing down the sink, washed the bowl out with soap, and started all over again. And I said, "Mama, what did you just do?" And she said, "I thought maybe I saw a blood spot." Now, mind you, we buy them from the supermarket, and you know, you get those. And I said, "Well, if you did happen to see a blood spot, can you just, like, dig it out, or... or even mix it in and just get cooked. It's not that big of a..." She says, "No, we never mix blood in food." And I said, "Well, where'd you get that from?" She says, "Well, my stepmother." Her stepmother was the granddaughter of Brigham Young. And then I said, I got to thinking too, and I said, "Ma, when we were little, we rarely had ham. I mean, we might get it on a pizza once in a great while, never a slice of ham." And she said, "Oh, no. You know, my stepmother taught us that we did not eat the meat of animals that had cloven hooves." And so I just said, "Shalom, Mama." You know, apparently we do. And then, so, you know, there are things out there like that. I have a memory from my childhood that really sears in my brain of being at my grandparents. And I was always interested in genealogy. This has been going on since I was 5. I just annoyed everyone. And so my mother would take me around to all the old people, and she'd say, "Now, Joanna's interested in family history. Can you tell her some stories?" And they'd tell me the stories, and we'd cry and carry on. We went up to my father's family, and I didn't know a thing about my grandfather, the one that's, you know, the Messenger Allen Savage line, the, you know, the real thick one. And so my mother said to my grandmother, she said, "Would you tell us about your ancestors?" And, of course, she told me all about her Scandinavian ancestors. And then I nodded politely, and I said, well, what about Grandpa's people? Now, Grandpa was a very quiet man. He sat in the corner. He didn't say a word. My grandfather had never interacted with me, spoke with me, anything. He just sat in the corner. And so I looked over at him, and my grandmother started to walk away. She flipped her hand up, and she said, he's just a little bit of everything. Now, paper, he's English, 100%. And so I said, well, what do you mean a little bit of everything? I was kind of a PC kid, and I said, are we talking about, because I really wanted to find some Indians. He said, do we have any Indians? Are we talking about all the countries in Europe? And she turned around and looked at me like I was a devil. I mean, and she turned around, didn't say a word, and walked out of the room, and everybody, and I looked over at my grandfather, he was laughing. Just falling over laughing. It was the funniest thing he had ever heard. And I was like, a man never moved. So then at my wedding reception, as a young bride, my husband's family, we found this after 20 years of marriage and 4 kids. That's why we say we adopted our 5th one. But we're 4th cousins. And so my grandfather, it was a shock, I'm telling you. My grandfather, I think, recognized, and I don't think he recognized individuals, but I think he recognized the look that my in-laws kind of had as they all filed in. And at one point in the our reception, he came up to me. And mind you, he'd never said anything to me. And he took me by the hand, he took my husband's hand, and he said, I want you to know that I love you. And he said, I want you to come up and see me. Would you promise me you will do that real soon? And I said, yeah. And then, you know, we were at school, we were working, and he died. So I never got a chance. And I kind of wondered if he knew something and he was going to tell me. Because what happened after the Civil War was that people were so upset about anybody having any kind of dark people in their family that they would, you know, they would hide it and just try to keep it hushed up. And these converso people were so far removed from their Jewishness, you know, why bring it up? Why cause trouble? So they just ceased to, you know, let anybody know. I think somewhere around the early 1900s, it all kind of ceased. It was interesting, we were down in St. George this weekend. I went to look at the tabernacle. The tabernacles are now kind of a hobby of mine. We went in and took a tour of it. Up in the front of it, on the outside, has a very Protestant look. And then the inside has that kind of synagogue look at the 2 levels. Except for the synagogues, they have the open space in the middle with the altar. Or, as you know, we fill it up with benches. But up on the wall is an enormous eye. And that's a Middle Eastern thing. It can mean several things. It can mean the eye of God. It can mean averting the evil eye. It can mean eye singleness to God. I mean, that's a pretty big symbol. So I kind of wonder if our ancestors were aware of it, the Jewish star. But at some point, you know, why bring it up? So anyway, that's what I have in my family. Marilee, do you want to say anything on that?
Just quickly, I was going to say I was looking up the Alhambra, and I saw fountain in which there were animals holding up the fountain like we have. They weren't oxen, but they were sheep. And I had never seen anything so similar. It was very interesting.
I was curious about your looking at the naming conventions where people would name their children using some familiar names. I thought, when I named my children, I don't think those kinds of things came up. And so I was curious about how they would do that. Is this family Bibles that they would keep along names? And if, before you answer that, I would sort of another funny statement about my own children. My first 3 children are David, Naomi, and Daniel. And because I really like the David and Daniel, Naomi happened to be my husband's old girlfriend. So, but I like the name. So we had David, Naomi, and Daniel. People say, oh, what a nice Jewish family. So we named our 4th child Christian. I wondered about that. How did they sort of gather together? I don't recall that kind of thought process in naming all the children.
No, I don't know too much about that. But let me just say one thing about Keziah. I'm also a descendant of James Hendricks and Drusilla Doris. And there were relatives of theirs. somebody had the name Charlotte, and then also on some legal document she had the name of Gaziah. And in my little Hendrix family book that I got handed down to me, they said, well, that must have just been her nickname. And so this isn't really an answer to your question, but it seems much more clear to Joanna and me that it was her true name, you know, in terms of her sense of her own identity. And Charlotte was kind of a form of passing, really. But the naming, usually the Jewish people name their children after the grandparents. And you don't always have to choose the same name. You can choose a name that starts with the same letter. I know that much. But the names, it makes it a lot harder. I mean, the naming pattern is interesting to observe, but it's hard because you have so many people with the same names, and especially when they've intermarried. And just like Joanna said, she's married to her fourth cousin, and my family's obviously did intermarried too.
When you send in for your genealogy, do they ask you for blood, or are you just using names?
What you do, I think, with DNA tribes, I assume all the rest of them, is they'll send you a packet with two big gigantic Q-tips, and then you take a morning where you know not a lot going on, and you don't eat anything that morning. You rinse out with salt water, and you swab the inside for 2 minutes. You wave it in the air for about 20 minutes. Immediately stick it in the package that they send you with it, run it down to FedEx as fast as you can, and they overnight it. And then in a week, 2, 3 months, whatever, it'll come back to you via email.
Cost
at that time when I did it was $170. I looked at DNA Tribe website lately, and it's kind of got more complicated. You can buy all sorts of different kits and different things, and that's why I was attracted to DNA Tribes in the beginning. It was just so simple. They just said, what is your tribe? And I went, okay.
It's expensive, but it's I consider it a gift to your descendants to start doing this. And DNA Tribes will give you, DNA's rapidly changing and improving, I assume. And so they will redo your old results for $99, which is pretty good. So once they have your DNA, you don't have to pay that amount again if you want to ask for an update.
One more thing on that's kind of interesting to note is that you don't inherit all of your parents' DNA. You'll inherit some siblings will get some others. So it's a good idea to go find the oldest people in your family. I'm really glad I went and did my parents. They both had Spanish and Portuguese, and I didn't have either. I suspect one of my sisters does. She looks kind of Spanish, but anyway, that's a good idea to do.
So your siblings wouldn't all have the same?
No, you wouldn't have the same mix. But my parents matched up, you know, pretty closely to it. One thing that neither one of them had was Northern Greece. And when I called DNA Tribes and said, okay, what was that? And they said, well, it could have been just an admixture of both of the families that came up with Northern Greece, and we probably don't have it. So, you know, you've got to be a little fluid in it and realize that there can be admixtures that can cause it, you know, to misfire. But you kind of look at the top ones, and those are pretty safe.
DNA Tribes told me that I was trying to figure out if I had any gypsy blood, and because I do have a couple of not very strong matches, but Roma. And they said that would primarily be called Northern India. So on the test, if it says Northern India, I don't know. And then what was the other one that they told me about? Oh, then the Jewish, I just looked up the history of the Majorcans, and it was obvious from the history that was what I was dealing with. But then it comes out on your test now sometimes as Israel. My son-in-law has Israel, and it sometimes comes out as the Levantine part of the world. It comes in kind of different ways. You have to piece everything together, but overall, you know, I mean, I consider the information I got to be, I mean, it really affected my sense of my ancestors and my identity. And you know, truth is just a pretty exciting thing to get closer to truth. We can't really tell what the future looks like, but to think that now we're going to be able to tell what the past, which was is so closed in so many ways, we really do are blessed.
Well, if there are no more questions, okay, we will conclude. And again, they should have these tapes ready by tomorrow morning. So let's have another round of applause.